This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Patty Labor reading from the New York Times Style section. For Maxine Hong Kingston, age is just time going by. At 83, the novelist and professor emerita at the University of California, Berkeley, likes to go into the new. By Ruth LaFlora. Updated April 24th. The Unstoppables is a series about people whose ambition is undimmed by time. Below, the writer Maxine Hong Kingston explains, in her own words, what continues to motivate her. In a way, I don't believe in old age. I hear people say, this hurts or that hurts, and they attribute that pain to old age. It's not age. Age is just time going by, and that's very mysterious. I don't think about vanity much. I look in the mirror, and if I think, I look young, that's good enough. Instead of wearing lipstick or rouge, I darken my eyebrows. I can express all kinds of things just with my eyebrows. I do think about retiring, but stories and ideas keep coming. As Phyllis Hoag, a poet and my best friend, used to say, we don't die until we've finished our work. I was born this way. From a very young age, I just wanted to be a storyteller or a poet. I didn't know what I was going to write. I wasn't even aware at that age that I had anything to write about. Sometimes I've thought, or had the illusion, that I've been this way for two incarnations back. This is my third reincarnation as a writer. John Whalen Bridge, who is writing my biography, is thinking of calling it American Boghesvita. I don't go around thinking I'm a Boghesvita, but I suspect that younger women see me in that way, as somebody who could help them, have mercy on them. That's the impact I'm having on young people. I just play the role of grandma for them. I'm not nostalgic myself. I don't like the feeling of nostalgia. Nostalgia has something to do with regret, the sadness of, oh, this time is over. I don't like it when I have that feeling, but I don't seem to get it very often. I like to go into the new. Current and upcoming projects? Second edition of Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace, a compilation of storytelling and poetry by wartime survivors with new contributions by Israelis and Palestinians, revising, polishing in her telling, a diary of the past decade. Unbuttoned, the metamorphosis of Mark Zuckerberg. The robotic nerd depicted in The Social Network has turned into the kinder, more accessible face of Silicon Valley. What's going on? By Vanessa Friedman, April 24th. In the run-up to Meta's first quarter earnings report this week, a video image of Mark Zuckerberg suddenly started going viral. Not because of the artificial intelligence assistant he was touting, or because of the unexpected ad revenue growth, but because of the silver chain he was wearing around his neck. Mark Zuckerberg made an announcement about something Meta is doing with AI, but I could not listen to or retain a second of it because when I look at the reel of him talking, all I see is the necklace, Amy O'Dell wrote in her Substack back row. Later, a doctored version of the same picture with Mr. Zuckerberg sparting some scruffy facial hair got people even more excited. The 4,000-plus mostly drooling comments under an Instagram post from the celebrity news account The Shade Room included one from Gwyneth Paltrow, who compared Mr. Zuckerberg to her ex-husband, Chris Martin. All of a sudden, it seems, people care a lot about how Mark Zuckerberg, 39, looks. At a time when the halcyon promise of technology has been cast in a darker, more suspicious light, the guy whose relentless allegiance to gray t-shirt became synonymous with the nerd pledge to move fast and break things has somehow become the kinder, gentler face of technology. The history of Silicon Valley has always been about a carefully constructed image and narrative used to reinforce its myths, said Venki Ganesan, a partner at the venture capital firm Menlo Ventures. But, he went on, the playbook is changing. and Mr. Zuckerberg has emerged as the most visible sign yet that in the phenomenology of Silicon Valley, we are entering a post-Jobsian age. Once upon a time, back in the days when Steve Jobs was the prophet of a better future through computing, the virtues of his approach to life seemed self-evident, including the adoption of an immutable daily uniform is the ideal form of dress. It freed the mind from the paltry concerns of such everyday choices as what color shirt goes with what socks. So annoying. Thus it was, too, with Mr. Zuckerberg, who went so far as to announce in a 2014 Facebook forum that he wore the same t-shirt every day because I really want to clear my life so that I have to make as few decisions as possible, other than how to best serve this community. Admittedly, it was a luxury version of a gray t-shirt from Brunello Cucini, but it was still a t-shirt. But after multiple trips by chief executives to Washington, D.C. to testify about the controversies about anxiety and depression caused by social media pressures, after the convictions of Elizabeth Holmes, she of the Jobs-like black turtleneck, and Sam Bankman-Fried, after the cesspool of conspiracy theories and anger that has emerged on X, after all that, the story, and its heroes' journeys, and its heroes' costumes, suddenly doesn't look so convincing. Behold the new, looser Mr. Zuckerberg. He has become, said Joseph Rosenfield, an image consultant and stylist who works with executives in New York and California, a more democratized figure. Arguably, the seeds were planted back in 2021 when Facebook turned into Meta and Mr. Zuckerberg's first avatar, dressed as he generally was in real life, and a t-shirt and jeans, turned out to have a closet of alternative outfits, including a skeleton unitard and an astronaut suit. The transformation picked up steam as Mr. Zuckerberg discovered the joys of mixed martial arts and started posting photographs of himself shirtless, sweaty, and with various bumps and bruises. It then reached a tipping point with the introduction of the platform Threads. Not long after Mr. Zuckerberg unveiled his open and friendly public space for conversation, he also unveiled his own new, friendlier look, one that focused less on an automated uniform and more on experimentation, everything being relative, as recorded via his Instagram post. Suddenly, it seems as though he was having fun with fashion. He cheerfully shared photographs of himself looking Yellowstone ready, and a chunky shearling coat by Overland. It seems to be the Maverick Rancher coat, which is the sort of subconscious tell Saturday Night Live might embrace. Next came snaps of himself and his wife, Priscilla Chen, and Anant Ambiani's three-day pre-wedding celebration in various forms of Indian-inspired finery. A gold silk Sunderbans tigress shirt from Rahul Mishra, a black Alexander McQueen suit embroidered with silver dragonflies and a pastel Flora Kurtu. And then Mr. Zuckerberg added a pic titled Jersey Swap, in which he and Jensen Huang of NVIDIA traded out outerwear, with Mr. Zuckerberg donning one of Mr. Huang's trademark leather jackets and Mr. Huang his shearling. By the time of his last jaunt to the Capitol, he had let his tightly controlled Julius Caesar haircut grow into looser curls. He's even started sharing shopping tips. When Jen Weisner of New York Magazine wrote an article identifying a sweater Mr. Zuckerberg wore as from the stealth wealth brand Loro Piana, he popped into the comments under the magazine's Instagram post to note that the garment was actually a crew neck from Buck Mason, a Los Angeles brand that focuses on American classics, not one from an Italian luxury house owned by LVMH. Then, when one of Mr. Zuckerberg's followers complimented a ribbed knit cardigan he wore on a date night pic on his feed, he jumped in with a tag, "It's at John Elliott Co. I'm loving their stuff recently." Other brands he favors now include Blanks by 13 Studios. He wore its white t-shirt to an Ultimate Fighting Championship match. Todd Snyder and Vori. They're kind of trendy names, said Derek Guy, who blogs about menswear at Dye Workwear. Everything has a different silhouette, like the sweatshirt with overly long sleeves or the t-shirt with dropped shoulder seams. Mr. Guy and Mr. Gannison of Menlo Ventures said they were convinced that Mr. Zuckerberg had enlisted professional help, which is to say a stylist, to help him develop his look. But a spokeswoman for Meta said that was not the case, at least for his day-to-day life. Mark mostly buys clothes he finds on Instagram, she said, though he does get input from time to time for formal events and occasions. Either way, Mr. Zuckerberg's pivot from the luxury labels made famous by the morally bankrupt millionaires of Succession to more contemporary brand means that he has now a stable of clothing that makes him an accessible figure for the world and his audience, Mr. Rosenfeld said. His new wardrobe also distinguishes him from rivals like Jeff Bezos, who has transformed himself into a real-life version of Iron Man with his bulging muscles, leather jackets, and yachts, and Elon Musk, who seems to be channeling a sort of Top Gun meets Goldfinger vibe. By contrast, Mr. Gannison said, Mr. Zuckerberg now looks like the buddy you want to call if you're doing backyard construction. Think of him as the tech dude next door. All of which matters because, Mr. Gannison went on to say, mainstream American could relate to that, and he's offering a mainstream product. And that, he said, is very good for business. Welcome to scam world. Digital life is cluttered with bogus text messages, spam calls, and phishing attempts. You can try to block, encrypt, and unsubscribe your way out of it, but you may not succeed. By Stephen Kuritz, April 21st. You open your eyes and grope for your phone. You check your inbox and discover dozens of spam emails that made it past the filter. Tapping over to Instagram, you find a request for a supposed brand collaboration in your DMs. Your WhatsApp's notifications, meanwhile, consist solely of strangers asking you to invest in a cryptocurrency exchange. A recruiting manager has contacted you through LinkedIn to say they're impressed with your unique background and journey and want to discuss exciting job opportunities at several Fortune 500 companies. While scrolling social media on your lunch break, you see a Tom Hanks promoting a dental plan and a Taylor Swift peddling a cookware giveaway. Or at least that's what seems to be going on. On the way home from work, you receive a text alert from FedEx with a tracking number and a link to update your delivery preferences, except you don't remember any pending shipments to your home. Should you click the link, pick up that phone, pursue that job opportunity? Is the person who texted you, hey, just now, from a number you don't recognize, someone you actually know? Welcome to scam world. The seedy layer just beneath the world we live in every day. It's cluttered with these bogus text messages, spam calls, and phishing attempts. In scam world, any engagement with a stranger is a risk. Thanks to spoofing, for example, which cloaks the identity and location of the computer or phone being used, a call could be from a helpful customer service representative or a cyber criminal pretending to be one. The internet is moving too fast for regulators to keep up with the quickly evolving deceptions. There are political donation scams in which someone masquerading as a campaign worker seeks a contribution. There are sextortion scams in which a person posing as a hacker claims to have recorded you watching porn through your laptop camera. There are medical scams, rental scams, employment scams. Seemingly, every facet of daily life now comes with an attendant scam, even death, when details in online obituaries result in identity theft. And the prospect that we may be deceived at any time leaves us feeling vulnerable, said Pamela Rutledge, the director of media psychology research in Boston. The lack of trust means you're not able to take information at face value, she said. You've got a heightened sense of vigilance. Groomed to be scammed. In the early years of digital culture, The border between the real world and the internet was firm. Surfing the web for an hour or two in the evening felt like a hobby, separate from the business of everyday life. Now we carry the internet around in our pockets and rely on it for practically every aspect of life. We are in the computer, said Rachel Toback, the chief executive of Social Proof Security, a cybersecurity company. Living our lives online has bred a misplacement, but necessary trust. It would be difficult to use TikTok, Uber, and Gmail every day while believing that doing so creates a perilous risk. Many people turn their brains off when they go about their business on these apps and platforms, Ms. Toback said, because it's so stressful to consider that these interactions are potentially harming. To be sure, there are still plenty of real-world fraudsters and grifters, some of whom, like Anna Delvey and Sam Bankman-Fried, have become figures of fascination. But a digital realm creates a bigger funnel at less cost for scams, said Corey Doctorow, a journalist and science fiction author who has written about the web since its early days. Mr. Doctorow noted that, just as the internet has made routine tasks less burdensome, it's also made scams much easier to pull off. Picture an old-school boiler room in which fast-talking con artists place hundreds of phone calls in an effort to fleece strangers out of their savings, he said. Now, fast forward to 2024, when scammers can send out millions of phishing texts and emails with the help of bots. If you can automate parts of it, Mr. Doctorow said, you can cast a much wider net. Text scams tricked Americans out of $300 million in 2022, the Federal Trade Commission reported. That same year, Americans received 225 billion spam texts, a 150% increase from the previous year, according to a report by RoboKiller, a company that sells spam blocker app. As digitally savvy and cautious as he is, Mr. Doctorow is not immune to phishing. In December, while vacationing with his family in New Orleans, he got a call from his bank asking if he had spent $1,000 at an Apple store in New York. In fact, the caller was a scammer who'd gotten hold of Mr. Doctorow's phone number and the name of his credit union, perhaps from one of the many data brokers that collect personal information and sell it to third parties, and then used spoofing software to appear as his bank on his caller ID. During the call, Mr. Doctorow gave out the last seven digits of his debit card number, enough information for the scammer to run up charges on his account. Sophisticated text makes this kind of deception possible, but Mr. Doctorow argued that, thanks to outsourcing and automation, the typical communication sent by the customer service departments of many large companies has become indistinguishable from a phishing scam. The prevalence of online deception can also add a bit of unwanted drama to mundane tasks. Recently, Ms. Rutledge, the psychologist, thought she was being scammed when she received a letter from a government office on the crappiest letterhead I've ever seen. This can't possibly be real, she remembered thinking. But it was. As Mr. Doctorow put it, the legitimate world looks so much like a scam that it's much easier to make a scam look like the legit world. A dystopian present. The science fiction author, William Gibson, who coined the term cyberspace, made a hacker the protagonist of his 1984 novel, Neuromancer, which is set in the 2030s. Some 25 years after he wrote it, he began setting his book not in the distant future, but in the present. The fraught landscape of the 2020s seems especially Gibson-like, a destabilizing, fatiguing grind in which the very technology we rely on makes us unsure that what we see and hear is real. Two recent incidents reveal how easy it is to get sucked into scam world. In February, a finance worker in Hong Kong was tricked into transferring $26 million of his company's money to fraudsters who impersonated his colleagues on a video call. The scam made use of deep fake recreations, sophisticated enough to make him believe he was speaking with his boss and other staff members. The phony promotions featuring Tom Hanks, and Taylor Swift used similar technology. Days after Bloomberg reported on the elaborate scam in Hong Kong, The Cut published a first-person account by Charlotte Cowles headlined, "The day I put $50,000 in a shoebox and handed it to a stranger." Toward the start of this story, Ms. Cowles, a financial journalist who has also written for the New York Times, writes that a polite woman with a vague accent told me she was calling from Amazon customer service to check on some unusual activity on my account. What followed was a psychodrama straight out of Hitchcock. After Ms. Cowles was informed that she was the victim of identity theft, she was transferred to an FTC investigator and then to a CIA agent. She learned that she was being investigated for federal crimes and that her phone was tapped. The hours-long ordeal, a drama entirely manufactured by scammers, played out over a phone line, contained all the ingredients of a modern scam, Ms. Toback said. They're spoofing customer service, building authority with sensitive details from data brokerage sites, using urgency and fear and appealing to authority, she said. The reaction to the stories were not universally sympathetic, and Ms. Cowles understood the complaints of critics who found her credulous. "Certainly, before this happened to me, I was someone who didn't think I was vulnerable to scams," she said in an interview. The numbers belie that reaction, however. More than 600,000 cases involving imposter scams were reported in the United States last year, costing Americans more than $2 billion, according to the FTC. The victims included Andy Cohen, the Bravo TV host, who went on NBC's Today Show in January to warn viewers of how he lost thousands of dollars to someone posing as a representative from his bank. Not long ago, online scams were much easier to spot. An elderly person ill at ease with the internet might fall for a clumsy, typo-ridden email asking for cash. But the rest of us were too web-savvy to be duped. Nowadays, the victims of internet fraud are more likely to be people who grew up online. In 2023, the first time 18 to 24-year-olds lost more money to scams than any other age group, according to the Better Business Bureau. TikTok is rife with Gen Zers posting about how they fell for an ad promoting a deal for a trendy mirror, or applied for a fake position on a job site, or had their email hacked by scammers who then hijacked their PayPal account. Being digitally native doesn't inoculate you. In fact, it makes you a target. Politely paranoid. Martha McCauley describes herself as a very organized person and someone who keeps her online passwords in an encrypted vault in Bitwarden. A writer and brand consultant who splits her time between California and New York, Ms. McCauley, 63, said she never clicks on a random link. "How do I know you're Chase?" Ms. McCauley asked the woman who called her last December. She had received a text from her bank asking if she had spent $2,400 at Walmart. When she replied no, her phone immediately rang. The caller ID listed the number as Chase debit card on her screen, since Ms. McCauley had put the number on the back of her card into her contacts. But you know where this is going. Ms. McCauley stayed on the phone with a woman, supposedly from Chase, for more than 2 hours, time enough for the scammer to drain her account of $50,000 through wire transfers. In a diabolical maneuver, the woman was also spoofing Ms. McCauley's number to Chase representatives to make the transactions. Her encrypted passwords offered her no protection, and Chase was not able to claw back the stolen money. "It's probably gone for good," Ms. McCauley said. "I'm now so paranoid about everything," she said. "I was having this dream this morning that my backyard was broken into." Ms. Cowles, the financial columnist, was similarly shaken after being scammed. She said she'd been thinking lately about the book Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini, which posits that when humans receive a favor of help, as happens during an exchange with customer service representative, they are wired to reciprocate. "That's a deeply embedded survival instinct," Ms. Cowles said. But now that we're so surrounded by information and noise, it's almost as if our ability to understand who to fully trust has gone haywire. We have to second-guess ourselves every day. The strategies people have used to ward off the risk of the analog world may not apply to the new digital reality, said Ms. Toback, the cybersecurity expert. We're in easy territory for attackers, she said. We haven't built up defenses. I'm skeptical about almost everyone, Ms. Toback continued, noting that when she was contacted for this article, she put the reporter's email address into a verification tool and used a second method of communication, reaching out on X. Only then did she feel safe enough to agree to a phone interview. Ms. Toback calls her approach being politely paranoid. She's had to repeat her multi-step verification process dozens, if not hundreds of times a week. Polite or not, she's learned to embrace the paranoia. As if to underscore what it takes to maintain security in scam world, she said midway through the interview, "This, by the way, is not my real number." Social cues. Can I ask my mother-in-law who my wife's biological father is? Although his wife has long maintained that she doesn't want to know the identity of a birth father, a reader's tempted to find out on her behalf, by Philip Galanes, April 24th. Ever since my wife was a girl, she was close to her stepfather, a lovely man who has now passed away. She always said he was her one and only father, and she had no interest in knowing who her biological father was. Recently, though, she hinted to me that she would like to know her biological father's identity. But time is running out. We're in our 60s, and her mother is approaching 90. Her mother is a forceful woman, and she has always been frank that it was her intention to become a single mother. She never mentioned the biological father's name, not least because it was a badge of honor for my wife to proclaim that she had only one dad. I intend to ask my mother-in-law who the man was, but I worry about upsetting the family narrative. Thoughts? Husband, I urge you to take a big step back and to consider the difference between supporting your wife and taking the reins on an issue that doesn't remotely concern you. I'm sure you mean well, and I have no idea how your wife hinted that she wanted to know who her biological father was. But a hint is not reason enough to make yourself a catalyst here. A better move would be to invite your wife to explore her feelings. Start by acknowledging her long-standing credo that she had a good father, and then ask if knowing the identity of her biological father would help or hinder her. Could it be useful information? Or does she worry that it would be disloyal to the memory of her stepfather, or upsetting to her mother, to ask about him? Your role is to help your wife make the best decision for herself, not to make it for her. Questions of biological parentage can be loaded for people who don't know who theirs are, so your wife may also benefit from speaking to a therapist about this. I understand your concern that time is running out, but that's no excuse for rash or possibly undermining behavior. Passing the digital tin cup. A distant relative sent a group text announcing a GoFundMe campaign to help her daughter take art classes. The campaign describes her daughter, a recent college graduate, as a starving artist. I don't know whether the daughter's employed or what the family's financial circumstances are. My initial impulse was to ignore the request. It seemed trivial, and I don't want to encourage young people to beg, instead of work, for what they want. Then it seemed possibly rude not to make a small donation. Advice? Donor. Charity is not about good manners. A charitable gift is a voluntary act of assistance to someone in need. So, if you're making a donation to be seen in a certain light, as generous, for instance, or polite, I would skip it. That's not charity, it's peer pressure at best, or possibly vanity. Here, if you're moved to help a young person study art, give. Obviously, it's not hard to envision more catastrophic need, in war zones, for instance, or arising from medical crises. But there's no need to characterize a young person asking for help as begging. You've admitted you don't know her circumstances. Give or don't give, it's your call. It's our time this week. This is Patty Labor. I've been reading from the New York Times Style section. Thanks for listening.